Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system, the home of Mario and friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder, or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. The Giants were playing the Patriots in Indianapolis. Super Bowl Sunday, February 5th, 2012. Elizabeth Griffin Hall was at work. As people across the country tuned into coverage of the big game, she drove her gray Toyota Prius into the cul-de-sac at 189th Street Court East in Graham, Washington. She steered between two pine trees that flanked the driveway outside a small brown house. It was about noon, Pacific time. Elizabeth parked her car and pulled the key out of the ignition. She worked for Foster Care Resources, a company contracted by the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services to supervise visitation in child custody situations. She was bringing Charlie and Braden Powell over for their usual Sunday visit with their dad, Josh Powell. Josh waited for them. He pulled open the front door of his rented house and looked at his sons. "I have a surprise for you," he said. The giddy boys took off at a clip up the short path between the driveway and the front door. Elizabeth hurried along after them. Charlie and Braden slipped past their father and into the house. Then, Josh looked straight at Elizabeth, right into her eyes. Without another word, he slammed the door and locked it. Nothing like that had ever happened before. Elizabeth pounded on the door. Josh didn't answer. She rang the doorbell. Again, no answer. She shouted, ordering Josh to open the door. She rang the bell over and over and over again. No response. Growing frantic, Elizabeth began to beg, "Please, let me in." Then she heard something terrible from the back of the house. Sobs. A child. Crying. One of the boys. Elizabeth reeled. Her pulse quickened and breathing accelerated. She smelled the unmistakable odor of gasoline. She went back to her car, pulled out her phone, and dialed 911. It was 12:08 p.m.
"Hey, I'm on a supervised visitation for a court-ordered visit, and something really weird has happened. The kids went into the house, and the parent, the biological parent, whose name is Josh Powell, will not let me in the door. What should I do?"
The dispatcher asked Elizabeth for the address.
"It's 8119, and I think it's 89th. I don't know what the address is."
"Okay, that's pretty important for me to know."
While looking, she said, "I think I need help right away."
"He's on a very short lease with CSHS, and CPS has been involved. And this is the craziest thing. He looked right at me and closed the door. Are you there?"
"Yes, ma'am. I'm just waiting to know where you are."
"Okay. It's 8119 189th Street, Court East, to Alec, 98375.
What happened next would haunt Elizabeth.
And I'd like to pull out of the driveway because I smell gasoline and he won't let me in.
You want to pull out of the driveway because you smell gasoline, but he won't let you...
He won't let me in.
He won't let you out of the driveway?
He won't let me in the house.
Whose house is it?
He's got the kids in the house and he won't let me in. It's a supervised visit.
I understand. Whose house is it?
Josh Powell.
Okay, so you don't live there, right?
No, I don't... No, I'm contracted to the state to provide supervised visitation.
I see.
Elizabeth told the confused dispatcher this was a high-profile case. Josh was the husband of missing woman Susan Powell.
And the dad's last name?
Powell, P-O-W-E-L, L.
Two L's? Two L's at the end of Powell?
Yes.
His first name?
His first name is Josh.
Black, white, Asian, Hispanic, Native?
He's white.
Date of birth?
I don't know. He's about 39.
She grew more agitated. The dispatcher told her he would have a deputy swing by.
Okay, how long will it be?
I don't know, ma'am. They have to respond to emergency, life-threatening situations first. The first available deputy...
This could be life-threatening. He went to court on Wednesday, and he didn't get his kids back. And this is really... I'm afraid for their lives.
Okay, has he threatened the lives of the children previously?
I have no idea.
All right. We'll have the first available deputy contact you.
Thank you.
Bye.
The call ended. Elizabeth backed her car out of the driveway and parked on the other side of the cul-de-sac, a safe distance away from the house. Then it happened. The house ignited. Fire, fueled by gasoline, moved so fast it seemed like an explosion. Heat made the windows burst, and thick black smoke billowed out. Fresh air rushed into the house, smothering some parts of the fire while stoking others. It was 12:16 p.m. Dispatchers started to receive more calls about the blast. Graham Fire and Rescue Station 95 sits less than a quarter mile away as the crow flies from Josh's house. It should have taken just moments for a fire truck to arrive. Elizabeth, watching in shock, could hear the wail of the siren. It seemed to swirl around her as if moving in a circle. She kept waiting to see an engine, but it didn't arrive. Flames climbed high above the trees surrounding the half-acre property.
Hello?
Hi, ma'am. Were you calling about the fire in the 8200 block?
Yes, he exploded the house.
Ma'am,
yes,
do you know the exact address of the house? Or are
yes,
you...
it's 8119 189th Street, Court East,
okay.
2 hours.
Okay, never yeah, mind. Do you know if anyone's in the house?
Yes, there was a man and
okay.
two children. I just dropped off the children and he wouldn't let me in the door.
Okay, stand line for the fire department. Okay, I'm going to get them on the line. Do not hang up. Hold on.
The dispatcher connected Elizabeth directly to the fire department.
I can hear the fire trucks, but they're not here yet. It's 8119.
There.
What?
We have an engine there.
And people are saying there's not somebody here, but I was just there, and there is somebody here. There's two little boys in the house, and they're 5 and 7, and there's an adult man. He has supervised visitation, and he blew up the house and the kids.
The kids and the husband and the father were in the house?
Yes, he slammed the door in my face. So I kept knocking. I thought it was a mistake. I kept knocking, and then I called 911.
Josh's final horrible act was no mistake. This is Cold, Episode 14, Killing Susan's Sons. I'm Dave Cawley. Josh's little sister, Alina, awoke that Sunday morning to find an odd email in her inbox. It was a foreword from Josh, something to do with his finances. More emails arrived throughout the morning. Josh told Alina, message by message, how to handle his affairs. Then Alina's phone beeped. She had a new voicemail.
Hello, this is Josh. I'm going to say goodbye. I am not able to live without my sons, and I'm not able to go on anymore. I'm sorry to everyone I've hurt. Goodbye.
Alina called 911.
I think my brother might be in trouble or something.
What's going on with your brother?
He's sending weird emails. He's saying goodbye and stuff.
The dispatcher asked Alina for her brother's address. Alina said she didn't know it. The dispatcher asked her for her brother's name. Alina said, Josh Powell.
Okay, was he going to have supervised visits today?
I think so. I mean, okay. He was supposed to normally on Sunday.
Okay.
I mean...
And this is what Josh has been in the media, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the one that's been being abused by everyone.
Alina struggled to keep her composure.
Alina, calm down. I understand you're upset. The more you're getting worked up, it's less helpful for me, okay? So I think I have an address for him off of Idiot. I have off of 189th Street Cordes is what I'm seeing.
Alina still could not confirm the address. Josh had only lived there a couple of months. She said she had never bothered to look at the street signs. And, in fact, suspicion persists to this day that Josh had never actually moved into the house, only staged it to make it appear as though he had.
I mean, I know it's hard on him. The abuse is extremely difficult.
Alina, I need you to calm down, okay? What else did the email say?
Nothing. He said several emails saying stuff about how to handle his property or something, how to camp for utilities. I don't know. It's different emails.
Okay.
And they started a while ago, and at first I didn't even think anything of it because there was some weird email that came in this morning that I just missed.
Okay.
And it didn't say anything from him. It was just some kind of forward or something.
Okay, no problem.
I just missed it.
The dispatcher told Alina a deputy would head to 189th Street Court East, but it would be very helpful if she could confirm Josh's address.
The only way to do that would be if I drive over there, and I'm terrified to drive over there.
Well, why send an officer over there so that he would know where we're going? We're not asking to make any contact with him. We'll have the officer do that.
I'm not afraid of him. He'd never hurt me. I'm afraid of him. I don't want to see him.
Oh, yeah, you are not helpful when you're crying.
The first sheriff's deputies pulled up to the burning house at 12:30 p.m., 22 minutes after Elizabeth Griffin Hall first dialed 911.
Multiple calls of a house. There has lots of explosions heard. Unknown if it's occupied. Flames are visible. Ladder 91 sees a huge plume and PD's aware. Be careful.
Chuck Cox was at church in a meeting in the bishop's office when his phone buzzed.
So I'm in there and I get this text or something or email or something from somebody. It said that Josh has blown up the house that they're in. And I'm going, no, where did you hear this? Oh, it's on Facebook. Okay, good. Facebook, I don't care. There's no controls on Facebook. You know, who knows what it is? So I said, okay, well, I'm not too worried about that. So, and I started to go back in, and it went off again. And then I says, well, who's saying this? And was Associated Press is picking this up. From the time I found out about it till the media gets it, until they start trying to get in touch with me, I know I'm going to have to answer questions. I know that other people are going to want to know, is it true, is it not? Somebody has to find out and actually look and see what's going on. So it was me, so I went and did what I needed to do to find out.
The CPS worker that deals with this residence, they believe that this fire was intentionally set. She is at scene. She believes that the dad and two children, ages 5 and 7, are inside the house.
Susan's friend, neighbor, and advocate, Kiersey Hellowell, first learned of the fire from a reporter.
Well, I just barely walked in from church and my phone started ringing. And I was like, oh, what is it now? What has Josh done now? So I answered it, and it was a reporter asking me if I'd heard that there was an explosion at the house Josh was renting in Graham, Washington. And I said, no, I haven't heard that. What do you mean an explosion? What do you mean a fire? Well, we just heard that Josh had the boys and that he had picked them up for his visit with them, and the whole house is up in flames. And I said, I can't talk to you right now. And I hung up and I immediately called Susan's dad, and he was driving to the house when he answered the phone. And I said, Chuck, is it true? And he said, I don't know. I'm on my way there, but I think it is.
So,
and then I just started sobbing. And then I called Debbie and I said, Debbie, I don't want to be the one to tell you this. I do not want to tell you this. And I told her, and she just said, no, no, no.
Debbie Caldwell had been Charlie and Braden's daycare provider when they'd lived in Utah. She had traveled to Washington to visit the boys at the Cox house just a couple of months earlier.
I think I called Debbie. I called the other people who would know and want to know and need to know that it was actual, and then let them start talking to me and do all that kind of stuff so I can kind of just recover from it, realize what went on.
Chuck called me, and all I said to him was, Chuck, Chuck, is it true? Is it true? And he said, yes. And I didn't even say goodbye. I just hung up the phone. I was in such a state of shock.
We're in shock. We expected that he cared about his kids. Turns out he didn't.
That's Josh Powell's brother-in-law, Kurt Graves' reaction to the news that Josh had taken the lives of his son and his own life in a home explosion.
Josh's estranged older sister, Jennifer, had just returned home from church when her phone rang. It was Kiersey. Jennifer could only manage to make out something about an explosion and the kids.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to go call Chuck and find out what's really going on here. So you just hang on, I'll call you back. And so I went in and found my husband in the other room, and he was in his office. And I didn't even talk to the kids, didn't even see the kids. I didn't want to bring this up in front of the kids. We were in his office and shut the door. We called Chuck. He said that he was on his way to figure it out. He wasn't sure what was going on. He was going to call us back. And so we were kind of just waiting on pins and needles, waiting for him to call back. And finally, I don't know how many minutes had passed, but probably at least 10 minutes before we realized, and before we finally decided, we can't wait any longer. We're just going to call. And so Kurt called him again, and Chuck had gotten there. And the house was a burned out, charred mess. And it was confirmed that Josh and the boys were in there and that they were dead. And it was such a such a weight, such a horrible thing my mind couldn't even comprehend. And it was kind of like I shut down. I just remember sinking to the floor, thinking, I should tell someone. This is really bad. And I should tell people that this has happened. And I sat there and I stared at my phone, trying to figure out how to make it work, because I couldn't remember how to send messages anymore. And I finally was able to get through that and figure it out and get my mind to work a little bit again. And I ended up sending this really, really blunt message to a whole bunch of friends and family. And I feel bad now because it was something to the effect of, Josh has blown up his house with Charlie and Braden in it and they're all dead. And I sent that, something like that. And it was, and I know, oh my goodness, I think now, and I think, oh my goodness, if I had received that message, oh, how horrible. And then I heard from people later, you know, loved ones and friends, and about when they received that text, and, you know, and my cousin was in the middle of church, and And she received that while she was sitting there in Relief Society and looked at that. And she stood up, kind of like me, you know, what do you even make of that? She stood up and just stood there looking at it, not sure what to do. And finally, as it came through into her mind, she finally just left, went and found her husband and her children, and they left. And, you know, just situations like that. Oh, my goodness. It was horrible. It was horrible. And then we came down, and we were upstairs, and we came down, and because the doorbell rang, and my neighbors across the street had heard, and they were coming to, you know, be here, just to be here with us. And I walked down the stairs, and I remember thinking, oh my goodness, my children don't even know. And then I had to stop and explain to them that their cousins had been murdered in a terrible house explosion. And of course, after that, I was still in a daze. It was just unreal. And we had other people that came, wonderful friends that just came and sat with us and fielded the media. Kirk went out, he talked some with the media a little bit. I could not deal with it. I could not do it. But they were camped all over my yard, my front yard. And I could not go out there. Even in the midst of it, I remember thinking, even through the pain, somewhere deep down inside, they're okay. They're okay because they're now with their mom and with Heavenly Father and Jesus. So that was like a little glimmer of light through the whole thing that just kept me from completely collapsing.
From engine 95, confirm one victim 3 feet inside.
The additional no victim found at the same location as the first.
Pierce County Sheriff's Detective Gary Sanders was getting ready for the big game.
I was making some chili con queso dip, and my pager went off because I was having a Super Bowl party that day. And back when we had pagers, we don't have pagers anymore, but it said, call dispatch in regards to Josh Powell. And I was like, that's weird. I wonder what's going on with that. So, you know, I called dispatch and it's like, hey, you know, Sanders calling about your page. And they go, Josh just blew up the house and he killed the boys with them and took the boys with them. And I was just like, you know, it was here to the bottom, you know. I'd played with the boys. The boys had been in my patrol car playing with the lights and sirens. I'd got to know the Coxes, started thinking about that, you know, how I felt for the Coxes. And I'm like, oh, crap, you know, I wonder if they know. And it just sucked. It was a bad day. And I'll forever remember that day. Where I live was maybe a mile and a half away, if that, you know, from where that was. And I drove over there, and it was still smoldering, and it was just a big chaotic scene with fire trucks and, you know, looking at the house of the devastation, you know, the gas that he'd poured and the way he'd done it, he made sure he took care of it.
Chuck Cox arrived shortly after Gary.
There's something there, so I had to go over and see for myself that was it there or was it not, and I saw that, yes, it was indeed smoke coming out of it, and then I knew what they would be looking at. I knew what the first responders were looking at.
Throughout his career with the FAA investigating plane crashes, Chuck had examined his share of fiery disasters. He reacted, as many pilots would, by falling back on his training and checklists.
In emergencies, I go into a really calm, do A, B, C, and A is the most important thing, and B, then C, and then I do this. And I'm just going into that mode, and I do what I need to do. So the first thing I need to do is go find out, is it true? Number two, I got to notify the people who are waiting to find out. So I told them. Number three, what do I do next? What can I do next? And then, well, cameras or go home.
Gary told Chuck there was nothing he could do at the house.
My wife, she didn't have a phone, so I don't know if she knows or not, so I got to go back there, because being here is not going to do anything.
Once the flames were doused, Gary walked through the still smoking remains of the house.
Even, I mean, we're pretty sure, because the 911 call with the social worker and seeing the boys go in, hearing them scream, and then the explosion, you knew what, but you still got to confirm it.
Josh had spread gallons of gasoline throughout the entire house, then ignited it.
Going through and seeing the bodies and stuff like that was a hard thing too. You know, just, you know, two little boys that were innocent and had no play into that. And unfortunately, mom had been taken away, so they'd been dealing with that.
Those three bodies were all together in a back bedroom. A blackened metal hatchet sat next to Josh's body. Gary could see that Josh had used it to bludgeon both of the boys about the back of the neck, knocking them unconscious. Coroners, though, determined the fire and smoke inhalation actually caused the deaths. Gary positively identified the bodies as belonging to Josh, Charlie, and Braden Powell. Dental records later confirmed that observation.
Fire does a lot of damage, but I think the explosion kind of put a lot of the fire out too, in some essence, you know, blew the roof off and stuff like that. And there was some damage, but you could tell, unfortunately, you know. It's one of those things that always will be up here because you can't tell.
We have a confirmed third signal.
All units at the house fire confirmed third signal one.
Like Gary, Ellis Maxwell was at home preparing for a Super Bowl party.
Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. You know, I was home and I had guests over to the house and, you know, doing what a lot of people do that watch Super Bowl Sunday teams go at it.
Ellis missed a call from Gary, then received a message from his lieutenant telling him something had happened in Washington.
And I get a phone call from Gary and he's like, he goes, have you heard? And I said, heard what? And he goes, sit down. And I was like, and so I went into my office and I sat down. I said, what's going on? And that's when he told me, it's like, Josh blew up the house with the kids inside. I think my first comment to him was, well, what the hell were the kids doing at the house? Because the kids weren't supposed to be having visitation at the house. It was supposed to be in a neutral location, in a kind of like a public but governed area. And I think my next thing was, are you serious? And, you know, because it was kind of like, I believed it, but I didn't believe it. And, you know, so it was crazy. It was an emotional, a roller coaster of emotions. I was upset. I was mad. I was sad. And I just literally wanted to just jump in my car and drive straight up there.
Ellis's mind raced.
Obviously it was all premeditated and he was ready and he was going to carry it out. Clearly Josh had made up his mind that he was going to carry out some sort of act of violence, whether it was upon himself or others. So whether or not that could have been prevented, I don't think anybody could say. You know, and it's possible. I mean, say if the Coxes had the kids and they were at home and he did some surveillance on them and, you know, maybe he blows up their house. And so instead of the three of them, now there's five of them or more.
Word spread among the rest of the West Valley City team. They made immediate travel arrangements.
Police won't comment about other details that involve Susan's case, but they are saying they're going to question Stephen Powell about it.
Dax and Mindy Guzman were renting Josh and Susan's other house, the one on Sarah Circle in West Valley City, Utah. Like Alina, they'd received strange emails from Josh. Then they saw the video of the fire on the news. In one of the emails, Josh had told Dax to take his old Yamaha Radian motorcycle from the backyard and sell it for scrap.
I was so mad at Josh, I took my sledgehammer, my saws, and I shredded his bike. I completely tore that bike apart right there in the yard. I was really, really, really mad and just went at it with my sledgehammer and just cut up the frame, cut up everything. It was just evil. I can't think it, I can't process it, I can't even like complete the process in my mind to do what he did. I played with those boys, hung out with those boys. It was getting close. That's why he did what he did. It was getting close. And part of me wishes that even, the boys, they were gone. But part of me wishes that he would have survived and just lived in pain the rest of his life. That would have been so great. Blind, not maybe lost his hands, his feet, whatever. Just been a nub of a person. That would have been okay with me.
We can put water through the window, but do not go in the structure unless absolutely necessary.
Javonna Owings, the last person besides Josh to have seen Susan alive, learned of the fire from her sons. They were watching Super Bowl coverage when the TV station broke in with a live report.
We were watching the live report, and I saw a house burning, and I saw police cars, and I think I saw a woman by her car in front, and she was being talked to by other people. And I said, "What?" And my boy said, "Josh just blew up his house and killed his boys." And I could not believe that. That stuff that people make up and put in a movie, it wasn't real to me that could possibly happen. But I did find out it was real, it did happen. And I was in shock for a good couple of days, just like, how could that happen? How could somebody do that to their children? I have a strong mothering nature, and I could never, ever do that to my children. I could not understand how a father could do that to his children either.
This was the first visit Josh had had with the boys since Wednesday's custody hearing, in which he learned he would not be getting his sons back.
Susan's neighbors weren't the only ones blindsided by the news. Her co-workers, Linda Bagley and Amber Hardman, were as well. Here's Amber.
I was at work, Super Bowl Sunday, I remember that, and all of a sudden my phone just started blowing up, like people messaging me, "Did you hear about the news? I'm so sorry." I hadn't yet, and we had TVs on everywhere at work. I mean, it's just how it is, and it was right there on the TV before I'd even had a chance to talk to anybody. I was just looking at my phone like, what is going on? I look up at the TV and there it is. And again, it felt like you were in a movie. It didn't seem real. It almost solidified that he had to have killed her. Like, if you can kill your children, if you can do that, of course you could kill your spouse.
Rod Stevens, who had helped Josh unload his U-Haul when he moved to Washington in January of 2010, had himself moved to Utah in the time since. He found out about the fire from his dad.
My father called me up and said, "Josh killed his boys and blew up his house." And it was in the morning when I got the call, and I was actually quite hurt for the boys. I could have cared less about Josh, but I felt really bad for those two boys.
Rod saw the murder-suicide as something of a confession.
Dads don't do that, right? You would sacrifice yourself long before you'd ever, ever let one of your kids get hurt. But not Josh. So what kind of place of evil he had to get to kill his two boys? Clearly he killed his wife. There's no doubt about it.
And now they're hoping they'll finally learn once and for all what happened to Susan after police are able to release more details about the case.
At this point, my feeling is Josh has just admitted to guilt.
Dark memories, long suppressed, rose from the depths of Catherine Everett's mind when she learned of Josh's final act. Catherine, who'd been Josh's only true girlfriend before he met and married Susan, had followed every twist in the case, ever since first seeing her ex-boyfriend on the news in December of 2009.
You know, when it first broke, it absolutely devastated me because I'm just like, this is not happening, you know? I'm like, this is absolutely too coincidental. How could this be going on? How could I know this person? And just knowing that it was very probable that Susan was gone, that he was absolutely and utterly capable of doing something like that.
She couldn't believe Josh had married, moved to Utah, and lived for years less than an hour's drive away from her house.
It took me to a bad place. Just, you know, mentally and emotionally, and I was just like, it made me think about a lot of things that happened between the two of us, you know, and just the way he was.
Like so many others, Catherine and her husband Dennis learned of the house explosion in Washington when they saw it on the TV that day. Catherine had celebrated her birthday just one day before. She wondered if Josh had intended to mark the date.
I have to be careful when I talk about it and when I think about it, because right after he had killed himself, I had some really, really disturbing dreams where he was there, but it was like he wasn't alive. He was obviously dead. And I'm like, I have to be careful about what I let in, you know, to myself. And I said, you know, I don't like to talk about it a whole lot. And I'm sure in some twisted way, he thought that he was going to be reunited with Susan and everything was going to be good and great. And I'm like, it's not the way it works. Those kids are going to go to their mom and you're not going to be able to touch them again.
Forensic psychologist James Manley, who had recommended Josh undergo a psychosexual evaluation with another provider, was at work on a different report that day.
I was working on a report, and the colleague that I referred to Josh to for the psychosexual texts me or something and says, look at CNN right now. So I did, and it was a helicopter shot of the smoldering home.
James was not so emotionally invested as Susan's friends or family. He hadn't spent the same amount of time with the case as the police, who had been nipping at Josh's heels for the prior 2 years. But at the same time, he was closer to what had happened than almost anyone. He had visited that house.
The intense violence that Josh had with his sons, talking to forensics, talking to the policeman, talking to the fire chief, talking to the social worker, or rather the agency supervisor that brought the children to the house that I'd just a week or so before cleared, along with the social worker, was fairly intense. I would say approaching trauma, but it really wasn't. It wasn't that close to me. But of course you backtrack and wonder, did I miss something?
The dispatch agency says the calls from the social worker are now under review. Jody Mayer is a communication supervisor at the dispatch center. She says 911 is often misunderstood. She and her agency is asking for time and understanding as the case is looked at.
Attorney Ann Bremner hadn't heard much from her clients, Chuck and Judy Cox, in weeks.
I didn't hear anything from them when they had those kids. Yeah, it was the first time that they were like, okay. They were just great. And so it was just a heartbreaker, you know, for them.
Anne learned of the fire from a reporter.
My phone rang, and it was a reporter from Utah, and said, did you hear? And I said, hear what? And he said, there was an explosion at Josh's house, and they think that three are dead. And I was thinking natural gas explosion, because he said there's been an explosion. And then I can't remember if I called Chuck or Chuck called me. I think Chuck called me. And I said something, is it true? And I think he said he was right outside the house. I'll never forget this part. He said, they're all gone. He goes, and we told him so. And I was just like, oh my God. I mean, it was just, I've never felt that sick before about something, you know. Just, I sat in my car for a long time.
Bremner says the Cox family doesn't know what's next. They're hoping the West Valley City Police release what information they have about the case now that their only person of interest is dead.
Pierce County Sheriff's Detective Gary Sanders left the house that afternoon.
After doing some initial stuff, I went over to Josh's or Steve's house and spoke with Elena and, you know, tried to see what she said. And she played the voicemail that he'd left people and stuff. And just unfortunate. It was, you know, so many ways.
He had another very difficult visit to make.
Went and spoke with Chuck and Judy that day. You know, and it just sucks in the element of here he took his daughter. And now he took the only two, you know, parts of his daughter that he still had, you know, taking them the way he did. And then hearing the way he did it, coward that he was, you know, just infuriates you.
Gary and his companion came over to tell me, yes, there was a hatchet involved and that confirmed officially, but that was hours later, you know, and I'd already been there. It got worse as more and more stuff came out about what really had happened to the boys on that day. Having had Braden in my arms before and seeing a fear in Braden's eyes and just actually more like a terror, because he just was living some kind of a horrible thing on in his mind, and you couldn't do anything for him. And I could just imagine him seeing Charlie get hit with a hatchet and then Dad coming after him, and just could imagine the terror that was in his eyes when that stuff happened. And that made it harder for me. But a father who claims he loves his children and can do that to them, and a family that still backs him up after all that, still.
Ellis and the West Valley team arrived in Washington the day after the fire, on Monday, February 6th.
It was hard. It was super difficult. You know, let alone I hate the smell of a fire after it's been put out by the fire department.
Pierce County had put up a chain link fence around the lot. Ellis could see the roof was gone, along with a third of the exterior walls. Almost all of the interior walls were gone, too. Only the skeleton of the wooden frame remained. The beams were gnarled and blackened. It had been hot inside the house. So hot, a wire birdcage had turned to goo. It looked like a piece of modern art. The remains of Josh's minivan sat in what had been the garage. The fire had burned the paint right off of it. The tires had burst, then burned to nothing. The window glass had shattered. Everything plastic had melted, including the headlights, taillights, and door handles. The seats were just metal frames and springs, no upholstery. A few items had survived. The investigators found a couple of scorched cell phones, three badly burned hard drives, a camcorder, a flash drive, and some other computer stuff. They also recovered a pile of Josh's old journals and personal papers. Those included postcards from three tourist attractions in Idaho: Shoshone Falls on the Snake River, the Shoshone Ice Caves, and Old Mission State Park outside of Coeur d'Alene.
Here you are going through this home and looking for anything that can be saved and you could potentially maybe get some answers from, all while in the back of your mind, your primary target, the person responsible for Susan, is now gone. And not only did he take himself, but he took his kids too.
If Josh had written any sort of confession letter, it burned with the rest of the house.
You know, you've got that playing in the back of your mind, and then you're thinking, oh gosh, you know, who would have thought that he would have took his kids out and murdered them? And so then you start second-guessing yourself and reflecting back on the years and going, is there something we could have done differently to prevent this and for it not to go, you know, to this extent? And so it was challenging. And, you know, it was something that, me personally, I had to work through for quite some time. and kind of reflect back and, you know, reflect on that day and the future of the case and, you know, where's Susan? And I mean, it's a lot.
Ellis called Josh's brother Michael on Tuesday, 2 days after the fire. Michael didn't answer. Ellis knew Michael was living in Minneapolis, pursuing a PhD at the University of Minnesota. So he called campus police and asked if they could track Michael down. They did, and confirmed Michael had no intention of talking to Ellis. That afternoon, police went to search Josh's storage unit in Sumner. They tested several items for blood. One indicated for the possible presence of blood. It was a comforter from a bed. The detectives took it. On Wednesday, 3 days after the fire, a pair of investigators went to the Pierce County Jail to talk to Steve. FBI Special Agent Jeff Ross showed Steve photos of the bodies. Steve wouldn't talk.
No, it didn't faze him.
He described that visit in a letter months later.
They continuously dangled pictures of three charred bodies to try to convince me that Josh was evil. And they tried to get me to talk about Josh. They repeated over and over, "You know Josh killed Susan," for 3 hours.
Steve told the FBI the only way he would share his story would be in a book. As Steve was facing off with the FBI, West Valley police were at the Land Recovery Recycling Center in Puyallup. They started sifting through the huge pile of trash from the previous week, looking for the stuff Josh had dumped the day before the fire. Pierce County called in volunteers to help. It took them several days, but the volunteers did manage to pull out several interesting items. Those included an issue of a church magazine called The Ensign from 1994, several books which Susan had owned as a kid, a road map of Utah with handwritten pen marks around popular tourist attractions, and a Portuguese language Book of Mormon with Josh's name embossed on the cover. Josh had at some point marked just 4 verses in that book of scripture with a red pencil. One of them was Mosiah chapter 26, verse 30. In English, that verse reads,
"Yea, and as often as my people repent, will I forgive them their trespasses against me."
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge premieres April 17th, streaming only on Hulu.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
In the days following the fire, a makeshift shrine to Charlie and Braden popped up along the fence outside of the burned-out house. Tammy Foreman, who had taught Charlie in kindergarten, said another went up outside Carson Elementary.
And then my kids knew about Charlie, and so my own children were very devastated. My daughter was obsessed with keeping those candles going, so every night she wanted me to drive her over to the school so she could make sure all the candles were lit, and that was really important to her. And if she couldn't go, she would ask her friends to go. And then she and her friends would go straighten out all the purple ribbons on the trees that people had put up in remembrance of Susan. Yeah, so I know that it was hard on my kids as well. I felt really numb, so it's hard to describe. It was like it wasn't real, like, you know, watching a movie about someone else, I guess. I felt very disconnected when I first heard about it. That day also is, I don't remember it very well. I was just kind of a mess. And the fact that it was so brutal is a lot harder. Like, I'd like, even if he had just blown up the house, that would be better than thinking that these boys went into the house to a dad that they trusted and that he chopped them up. I can't imagine. I can't imagine. And almost everyone that I know has some connection to that day. They saw the flames or they know people that were involved, and it really devastated our whole community.
Tammy felt angry. She couldn't understand why Josh had been allowed to have visitation at his house.
For a long time after the explosion, I would think I saw Josh. It was the weirdest thing. He might have a common look to him or something, but all the time I would do a double take because I would think I saw him at the gas station or the store or somewhere. And it took a long time for me to stop having that experience. I don't know why. And I didn't think that I saw Charlie or Braden. I just would think I saw Josh frequently.
Nancy, from the Puyallup Gem and Mineral Club, found solace from her grief among friends.
One good thing was the club. We would have our regular meetings. And so it was discussion, the major discussion, should we contact the Cox family? Should we bother them with our feelings? We're just this little rock club. Who cares about us, really? But another club member said, you know, those boys were here. They were club members. And they sat on our laps and they spilled stuff and they ran and they fell down and they got up and they made us laugh. And they were club members. There was a stone that the boys were interested in. And that's kind of a whole another story, but Josh had taken the boys to a club member's house who had a shop in his house, and he wanted to cut a stone for the boys and polish it and give it to them because he was drawn to them as well. And he was an older man, so they'd be like grandkids to him. So they went to his house, they picked out a stone, and he sliced it and he polished it, and he was going to give it to them. And it never happened because they died. They were gone. So with that, we still had this stone. So our club decided to put a plaque on it and get it to Chuck and Judy. So I'll take credit for what it says on it because I'm the one that decided that it would say this. And what I took it to a trophy shop and had a plaque put on it that said, Charlie and Braden, forever in the arms of an angel. They mounted it on the stone, and then we got a hold of Chuck and Judy, and we went to their house. Chuck wasn't there, but we got to have a long discussion with Judy, and it was eye-opening, the young couple that she watched pretty much dissolve and turn into what it was. But it was profound. It was profound and touching.
And while police try to find answers, Chuck says he's busy planning a funeral. He says it will be a public one. And Chuck says he's grateful for the community's support and hopes those mourning the loss of his two grandchildren will remember how truly innocent and wonderful they were.
Chuck and Judy Cox arranged to inter Charlie and Braden at Puyallup's Woodbine Cemetery. Susan's disappearance had been the stuff of network and cable TV for more than 2 years by that point. Josh's murder-suicide made national news. the Coxes knew the boy's funeral was going to draw a lot of attention. So they planned two services, one for the public and one for the family, scheduling both for Saturday, February 11th. The first took place at the Life Center Church in Tacoma. The church provided a live video feed. Tammy Foreman, Charlie's kindergarten teacher, accepted an invitation to speak.
I was really surprised because when I got there, I was immediately taken in to where the family was. And that was really awkward because there were people on both sides of the family there and people who didn't want to talk to each other. So it was a very uncomfortable situation. But on the other hand, I really appreciated being treated like family and having them just bring me right in.
Josh's mom, Terry, and sister, Alina, sat in a separate section of the auditorium, segregated from the rest of the crowd. Josh's brother, Michael, didn't show up, having stayed in Minneapolis. During the service, Pastor Dean Curry praised both families for setting an example.
These two families who have had so much, who have had so much pain, have come together, have set aside very dark and hurtful moments to celebrate children.
Tammy told the crowd Charlie had been a little scientist who'd always had a smile on his face when he knew he was being clever.
He was an amazing young man. He had an appreciation for nature that I have never seen in someone so young. He loved rocks, sticks, leaves, and bugs. He collected these items at recess and always had a hard time parting with them when it was time to return to class. He often left them by the outside door so he could play with them later. On many occasions, he tried to sneak a worm or caterpillar into the class. He was a good sport whenever I caught him, and he would make sure the bug was safe and sound before joining the class. He loved learning facts. He called nonfiction books real books, and he had an amazing ability to remember what he learned.
Christy King from the Melcorum Family YMCA pre-K program called Braden a tickle monster, a budding puzzle master, and a vehicle boy who loved cars, trucks, and trains.
It was obvious that Braden loved his grandparents. At the end of each preschool day, he would look out the window to wait for his grandma to pick him up, telling everyone how much fun he had with them and how much he loved them. He just leapt into her waiting arms. He had a heart of gold, always wanting to show affection. Braden liked to hold his teacher's hand and not let go. He was cuddly with his grandparents, aunts, and cousins. Teachers, classmates, and even first-time visitors to the house were showered with Braden's hugs and I love yous. And always there was that big, beautiful smile on a face so like his mother's.
Pastor Tim Atkins, who had counseled Josh in the child custody case, spoke. So did Tim Sloan, a longtime friend of the Cox family.
We must press forward. We have to learn from this experience and strive to become better fathers and mothers, to have more patience and love and kindness, to withhold our anger, to be gracious to others as the Savior is gracious to us and long-suffering with us.
At the conclusion of the service, Chuck and Judy Cox stepped to the microphone. Tears fell from Judy's eyes as her husband addressed the crowd in a soft voice.
All their teachers, their social workers, the police, everyone was doing everything they possibly could to keep them safe and to help them and love them. We thank you for your support. We know that they're with their mother. Thank you very much.
Then the family followed the single light blue casket to a hearse, which took the boys to the South Hill ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There, the Coxes held their second private ceremony for family members and close friends.
Sitting in Charlie and Braden's room, Chuck Cox finds strength in knowing where his two grandsons are now.
We believe that she's safe in our Heavenly Father's arms and the children are there with her. There's been a reunion.
Terry and Alina Powell had inquired with the Woodbine Cemetery about having Josh buried next to the boys. that had caused an uproar in the days prior to the funeral. Pierce County Sheriff's Office spokesman Ed Troyer was not about to let that happen.
He and our sheriff did a big push for that and made sure that didn't happen, along with Crime Stoppers. That was a big thing. We were not going to let him be buried next to his boys after he killed their mother. So, yeah, yes, exactly.
The family laid Charlie and Braden to rest at Woodbine Cemetery on Monday, February 13th. A single headstone marked their grave. At the top, it showed a picture of Susan and her boys together, smiling. The words, "United in Heaven," were engraved at the bottom. Just below Susan's name and the words, "Missing, December 6th, 2009.
Ultimately, it would be nice someday to find Susan so we can bury her next to him and they can be together, but we know now that they are together.
Josh's name did not appear anywhere on the stone. This is not the end of our story. The search for Susan will continue in episode 15. But this feels like an appropriate moment to express my sincere gratitude to all of the people who have shared their memories of Susan, Charlie, and Braden. They were loved. They are still loved. And they will not be forgotten. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, financial control, emotional manipulation, threats of violence, verbal put-downs, whatever it is, please reach out for help. You are not alone. Resources and advice are a phone call away. In the United States, you can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-7233 or by going online to thehotline.org. Cold is a KSL podcast. Thank you for listening.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.